Iran slams the U.S. and Israel for their involvement in the assassination of top Iranian officials and the West's support for anti-Tehran terror groups. A new report describes as extrajudicial execution the last year's killing of a Palestinian man who was left by Israeli forces to bleed to death. Also in the headlines, Ghana becomes the first country in the world to receive the coronavirus vaccine shots under the World Health Organization's COVAX scheme. Thanks for joining us. The head of Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says U.S. sanctions have grossly violated the absolute rights of the Iranian people to have access to humanitarian aid.
I speak of a nation whose absolute right, including the right to health, the right to food, the right of access to humanitarian aid, and the right of access to peaceful nuclear technology have been grossly violated by the illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. regime and its implementations by a number of Western countries.
Ali Bagharikhani was speaking at a high-level session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. He noted that sanctions have even deprived Iran of purchasing medicines for children suffering from butterfly disease. Bagharikhani said that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration has led to the maximum violation of the rights of Iranians. He slammed as politically motivated the claims of human rights violations made by some Western countries against Iran. Further in his remarks, Bagharikhani lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for assassinating the country's top general Qasem Soleimani and nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He said such murders show that Iran pays the price for fighting terrorism.
The assassination of the greatest defender of the right of nations in the region against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. regime, and the assassination of our scientists of the field of peaceful nuclear science and technology, including martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, by the Zionist regime, are but a portion of expenses paid by the Iranian people in the fight against terrorism.
Bagharikhani further said that Iran has been at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. He added that some Western countries have praised the notorious anti-Tehran terror group, the MKO, which has killed thousands of innocent people. A new forensic report has questioned an Israeli narrative of last year's shooting death of the Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank, calling it an extrajudicial execution. Ahmed Arakat was shot at a checkpoint in the city of Bethlehem in June 2020. Israeli forces then claimed that Arakat was shot after he attempted to ram his vehicle into a soldier. But Forensic Architecture, a London-based group specializing in the investigation of violations of human rights, says the 27-year-old posed no threat to Israeli soldiers or to any property. The report by the group says the victim was also not given any first aid treatment and was left to bleed to death for more than an hour. Arakat's family has now appealed to the international community to help secure the release of his body, which remains with Israel. The U.S. says it intends to return to the Geneva-based United Nations Human Rights Council to eliminate, quote, disproportionate focus on Israel.
We need to eliminate Agenda Item 7 and treat the human rights situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories the same way as this body handles any other country.
Top U.S. diplomat also said that Washington would seek a seat on the UNHRC panel for the 2022-2024 term. Lincoln urged member states to support Washington's bid. He also called on the UN body to change its stance on Washington's key ally, Israel. That is while the UN adopted 17 resolutions in 2020 against Israel for its violations, including those in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Elections for membership on the 47-member council are due at the UN General Assembly in October. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the rights body, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel.
The next speaker.
The World Health Organization has delivered the COVID-19 vaccine shipment to Ghana, making it the first country in the world to receive shots under the organization's COVAX scheme. A flight carrying 600,000 doses of AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, produced by an Indian firm, landed in Ghana's capital, Accra. Local representatives of the WHO and the United Nations Children's Agency have described the vaccine's arrival as, quote, momentous occasion. They also called the move a critical step in bringing the pandemic to an end. The UN-backed COVAX initiative, which was launched 8 months ago, aims to ensure fair distribution of vaccines between the rich and poor nations. Under the COVAX program, the UN Health Agency is expected to deliver some 2 billion doses of COVID vaccines to member states by the end of the year. At least 16 people have been killed and over 50 have been injured in an attack by the Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria's northeastern state of Borno. Security forces say the terrorists fired two mortar shells on the densely populated city of Maiduguri. 9 of the dead were young boys who were hit while playing football. Boko Haram has repeatedly made incursions into Maiduguri, aiming to overrun the regional capital. Since gaining widespread exposure in 2009, the terrorist group has killed over 36,000 people and displaced around 2 million from their homes in Nigeria. The Boko Haram insurgency has caused a dire humanitarian crisis in the region, including in neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. Authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say that around 3.4 million people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. Authorities said that over 200 countries, or counties, were reporting water issues as of Tuesday evening. The number was much lower compared to Monday, when over 7.9 million people faced water disruptions. The freezing weather conditions left dozens dead and knocked out power stations in Texas. It took several days for the authorities to restore power. Fresh water and food have been distributed to residents, with long queues formed in some locations to receive the supplies.
The U.S. state of Texas is still grappling with the fallout from a deadly storm that created apocalyptic scenes across much of the state's southern and central parts last week. The heavy snowfall and the subsequent disruption of electricity and water services prompted Texans to stand in long lines for hours every day outside churches, community centers, and parking lots to get safe food and drinkable water. Texan authorities said millions still have no water at all.
Been here up since 5 o'clock, and I've been on the road since 6. And I know it's 11:30, but I'm gonna sit here until I have no choice. All the stores in my area are out of water.
It's pretty tough to find bottled water. We are having to boil, to wash dishes or do anything.
Yeah, we're out of water, so not good.
Executive Director of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, Toby Baker, said lack of water is affecting about 14.3 million residents out of a total population of around 29 million. People across Texas were also advised to boil water before using it. This as officials distributed fresh water and food to thousands of Texas residents. The record-breaking freeze also knocked out power stations there.
I'm number 10. I'm very frustrated. I'm a diabetic. I have a 94-year-old senior that's a diabetic. We haven't had no medicine or nothing. I'm on insulin, and I haven't had no insulin. We can't get nothing. So I'm really frustrated mentally, but I'm keeping it together.
The storm has already killed many, prompting President Joe Biden to approve a major disaster declaration for Texas. Biden also called on federal authorities to coordinate disaster relief in neighboring states of Louisiana and Oklahoma that also got hit by the extreme weather.
The disruptions in Texas and elsewhere in the U.S. serve as a grim reminder that the U.S.'s aging infrastructure needs renovation. Now, this was especially highlighted a couple years ago when the U.S. received a grade of D+ by top engineers in the country. And that has come to light, especially after scientists warned that global warming could have severe consequences for the people across the U.S. Well, upgrading or renovating the faltering U.S. infrastructure will require a huge budget, and that's a major challenge, especially in a country that is suffering from the worst case of COVID-19. Congress and the new U.S. administration are widely divided over how to tackle these challenges and how to renovate the country's infrastructure.
The severe winter storms have caused widespread blackouts in several states, including Texas, Oklahoma, and Mississippi. Drinking water systems in Ohio and several other states were knocked offline. Road networks countrywide were paralyzed, and vaccination efforts in 20 states were disrupted. That said, one-third of the U.S. oil production was halted due to severe weather conditions. But as these states are struggling to restore electricity and water services, signs of the risks posed by extreme weather conditions to America's aging infrastructure crops up across the country.
So it isn't just an infrastructure aging issue in Texas, it's a political decision to do extreme deregulation. And then the infrastructure couldn't work, and once the power went out, so did the pumps for the water. And since most people heat by electricity in Texas because they don't use it very often, the pipes froze, so they broke, and when that happened, the water pressure dropped. So even when they got water back or got electricity back, the cities couldn't turn on the water until they fixed the leaks, which is what's going on now.
But the crisis is not just limited to what happened last week in Texas and several other states. It carries a profound warning. The New York Times says as climate change brings more frequent and intense storms, floods, heat waves, wildfires, and other extreme events, it is putting a growing strain on the foundations of the U.S. economy. That is, its network of roads and railways, drinking water systems, power plants, electrical grids, industrial waste sites, and even homes. The report argues that failure in just one sector can set off a domino effect of breakdowns and hard-to-predict ways.
Anybody who studies the issues of breakdowns of infrastructure knows that you have cascading effects. So if you have, for instance, say, the tunnel underneath the Hudson River, if that's the only rail link with New York and New Jersey, it's 100 years old, if that fails, the economies of both of those entities are going to be in deep, deep trouble, which will cause other problems.
According to New York Times, much of the country's infrastructure was built decades ago under the illusion that the environment would remain stable. Sewer systems are overflowing more often as powerful rainstorms exceed their capacity. Coastal homes and highways are collapsing as intensified runoff erodes cliffs. Homes once beyond the reach of wildfires are burning in blazes they were never designed to withstand. Now, with President Biden calling for a major push to upgrade the nation's infrastructure, getting a closely divided Congress to spend hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, would be a major challenge. Otherwise, with scientists warning that an overall rise in extreme weather could create sweeping new risks, one could not imagine what will be waiting for the people across America.
The president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has accused the U.S. and its allies of deepening the economic crisis in the South American country by imposing illegal sanctions. Legal experts say such sanctions amount to crimes against innocent people. From Caracas, Jesus Silva has more.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argued that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Crowds of Ecuadorian indigenous people have arrived in the capital, Quito, to protest an alleged electoral fraud. Protesters demanded a recount of this month's presidential election. The left-wing indigenous leader, Yaku Perez, addressed them. He said of the nearly 40,000 voting sheets, almost half have inconsistencies. Perez said that has denied him a place in the runoff. Ecuador's Elections Council this week confirmed that left-wing economist Andre Arauz and conservative banker Guillermo Lasso will advance to the runoff. The vote is slated for April 11. Protesters have once again taken to the streets in Myanmar to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Hundreds gathered in Mandalay and the largest city, Yangon, chanting slogans against the military. The protests have continued unabated for more than 2 weeks in defiance of enhanced security measures by the military. The civil disobedience campaign has continued. People want civilian leaders to be reinstated and detained officials to be released. Myanmar's army seized power on February the 1st. An alleged fraud in November elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against the pro-military party. So far, three protesters have been killed and hundreds arrested. Ne San Lwin, the coordinator of the Free Rohingya Coalition, says a major goal of the protesters in Myanmar is to change the current constitution that gives power to the military.
The protests are increasing day by day, and across the country, millions of people are taken to the street, and they are protesting against this military coup. They don't want this military dictatorship at all. And also, most of them agree to demand to abolish the 2008 constitution, which was created by this military regime in 2008. Now the trend is they are targeting to abolish this constitution, which will enable the equal rights, justice for all, because this constitution is controlling by the military, and they are sharing the 25% seats at the parliament and also the some ministry. The minister needs to be appointed by the commander in chief, and they are from the military. So I think the movement they call the Myanmar Early Spring Revolution, this will be, if they go continuously like now, I think the military will not last this time.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. steel and steel products, copper and copper concentrates, cement and clinker, lead and zinc, building decoration stones, tile and ceramics are the minerals that Iran exports to neighboring countries, China and the countries of Southeast Asia. Iran's Mines and Mineral Industries Development and Renovation Organization, IMIDRO, in cooperation with the private sector, have planned to launch new development projects worth $2.3 billion in the current Iranian year. These projects will create 8,300 jobs directly and 64,000 jobs indirectly. Thus, over 70,000 jobs will be created in this area. IMIDRO has been formed with the aim of meeting the domestic needs to mineral products in a bid to optimize the country's economic system in the mineral sector and affiliated industries, and also supervise the usage of mineral reserves and their proper exploitation. Accordingly, implementation of projects for construction, development, equipment, and renovation of industries related to production, excavation and processing of minerals, and implementation of exploration works are among the long-term goals of this organization. Mineral activities and industries enjoy competitive privileges in underdeveloped regions. Some of these privileges include potentials for the growth of investment in chain units of mine sector and mineral industries with modern technologies and development of mineral activities and mineral industries abroad with the aim of integration of value chain in production sector. These form part of strategic activities to bolster mines and mineral industries. In view of this, like the past year, IMIDRO is implementing the project of revival of stagnant mines of private sector with a broader plan, which is an important step toward providing feed of production units and leap in production of mines and mineral industries. Last year, 146 mines were revived, part of which has entered the production sphere. It is estimated that, with complete activation of these mines, 3,000 jobs will be created annually in this sector, and a notable part of the feed of processing factories will be secured from these mines. This year is also the year of yielding fruit of steel manufacturing of steel industries. Last year, Mubarake Steel Company and National Copper Industries Company managed to materialize the investment growth, and Golgohar Company of Sirjan has also stepped in the same route. But due to the problems caused by coronavirus outbreak, investment growth has been postponed in Golgohar. After these three companies, another huge company is in the route, namely Chador Malu in Yaz province. To this, we should add the project for production of 10 million tons of steel at the special Persian Gulf zone per year. Part of this project has been implemented, but the other part is going to be finalized with the participation of regional companies. Moreover, another project is underway in the southernmost region of the country, that is Chabahar. Once accomplished, this project will turn Makran coastlines into the hub of producing 10 million tons of steel per year. The mines and minerals have seen a two-digit growth in exports in the past year. gigantic complex of Sangan as the capital of Iran's iron ore will host new factories for production of iron concentrate and iron ore. Sangan Mineral Company is going to produce 17.5 million tons of iron concentrate and 15 million tons of iron ore. Presently, Iran is one of the greatest producers of gas-based sponge iron and among the 10 producers of steel in the world. This comes while Iran has been put several times under the most brutal sanctions by the U.S. The upsurge in production, exports, explorations, and implementation of development projects promise a great leap in production in the mineral field of economy. As the mines and mineral industries are based on exploration, 400,000 kilometers have been added to the area of the related activities during the past 1.5 years. This has been unprecedented in Iran. These explorations have yielded in identification of 760 promising areas. Exploration of new mines in the country will definitely play a key role in leap in production. In spite of global sanctions orchestrated and spearheaded by the U.S., production and trade has been on the rise during the past 2 years of 1397 and 1398. However, according to the report of the Parliament's Special Commission for Support of National Production and Supervision of Implementation of Article 44 of the Constitution, the industry sector has not gained the position that it should. This comes while there are high capacities and potentials in the sector due to the high technical know-how and big number of graduates in production engineering. These potentials should be applied for boosting of production and leap in production.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
inside Israel.
Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. But activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime, in its nature, is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for a political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli Ambassador Zipi Hotoveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide, and of course Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say, everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred toward Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspect of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. The answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are using the weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anak sarcastically says, people are calling Beteslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the State of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. Could say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger, with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses. We dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year, in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achille Mbembe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The state of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. There, the countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights. And you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semitic. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialist, they say that they are communist, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, a liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur B'Tselem through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodore Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish. But of course, oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews. So it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term, anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not at the moment Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Police officers were pelted with stones as they arrived at an independent Haredi school in Beit Shemesh that was opened despite the regime-mandated closure of all academic institutions during the current lockdown. Israel police said the volunteer fired into the air as he believed his life was in danger. There were no casualties in the incident and police reinforcements were called to the scene. According to the police, as the police officer was trying to locate the director of the educational institution, a crowd began to gather around the volunteer was standing next to their car and began hurling stones at him. The police officers left the scene without being able to have the school closed. The Jerusalem Post. The personal information of about 140,000 confirmed coronavirus patients in Israel was sent to the Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, without notifying them, in a clear and serious violation of several privacy laws. In a letter sent to Health Minister Yuli Edelstein on Friday, chairman of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, member of Knesset Zvi Hauser, Derech Eretz, referred to the unusual incident as a serious malfunction and said that it will have an unbearable negative effect on the public's trust in the regime. I-24 News. The United Arab Emirates has suspended the visa waiver agreement with Israel, initially set to come into effect in February until July 1, 2021, Israel's foreign ministry announced. Until July 2021, Israelis looking to travel to the UAE will have to obtain entry visas, unless notified otherwise. The same rules apply to Emiratis planning a trip to Israel. The decision followed complaints from health officials, while Israeli diplomats are said to have opposed it, wary of damaging the nascent formal ties between the two countries. The Times of Israel. A growing number of ultra-Orthodox Torah schools are reopening despite regime directives to remain shuttered as coronavirus infection rates remain at all-time highs, according to multiple reports. These join institutions of more extreme sects that have refused to close throughout the lockdown. The Haaretz report said the limited opening of more schools would likely have a domino effect and lead to more and more returning to studies in the coming days.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.